This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. At the top of the show, we talked to the head of the powerful U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. HUD, as it's called for short, has programs that could help keep some people in their homes. Economist Julianne Malveaux is going to give us her take on HUD and how to pass wealth from homes or land from generation to generation. Dr. Malveaux is the president of Bennett College. Dr. Malveaux, welcome.
Thank you, Farai. How are you?
I am doing great. So we just heard from the HUD Secretary, Steve Preston. HUD has a mixed history. Sometimes it's viewed as doing good work. Sometimes it's viewed as ineffective. It helps low-income families. It takes on financial scandals sometimes. Now, what do you think are the successes and failures of HUD in recent years?
I think we can go back and look at HUD's history and see why it exists. I heard you ask Secretary Preston about its existence, and when we go back, we find a very mixed history. Home ownership is always seen as a cornerstone of middle-class life in America, and from the 1930s, HUD was actively involved in investing in housing, in building housing, in providing home loans for veterans and for others. There is a book, which I wish I could put my hands on, which talks about HUD's role in maintaining blighted inner cities by declaring that housing that was mixed was considered unstable. So HUD might have subsidized a suburb, but discouraged the participation or the residency of a black family there. Now, this goes way back, of course, to before World War II, but I think it's useful to note the way that HUD has been used to reinforce the social norms of the time and the social mores, often in violation of any notion of full citizenship for everyone. Very recently, I was tickled, as in very amused, to note that the Bush administration had issued a press release on July 29th of this year, basically declaring victory over homelessness. Homelessness, according to them, is down by about 15% a year for the past several years. And my questions are always, how are you counting this? What neighborhoods are you going to? Because we know that there is still, if there's not a homeless problem, we know from the foreclosure crisis that there's a doubling and tripling up that's happening in some lower middle class families where people are indeed being foreclosed.
Well, let me jump in because I want to make sure that we get to these topics about wealth transfer, but it sounds as if you have some very specific critiques. Is there anything you think they're doing right?
I think that the Bush administration focus on home ownership was right with an asterisk. In other words, if we find after some analysis that focus on home ownership got people into bad loans, then there's a problem. Those people are actually due some repair. I think that if we go back earlier on, there has been an ability for people to get into homes. It's just which people, Farai, and at which times. So I don't think that it's been even. I think that a lot of people who've been HUD eligible who have not been able to get loans through the FHA. And so we've got, I always ask questions about equity. Even if it's a great program, if the underserved can't get into it, then that's a problem. I think the other thing that we all have to admit in terms of public housing is that HUD has done a poor job. They've made a decision, again, based on this administration's priorities, that they didn't like public housing. So if you go to New Orleans, you'll find public housing that was boarded up, that was perfectly usable, which has exacerbated basically the population flight in New Orleans. And then let's not talk about what's happened in New Orleans. I think that you did a great job in being very tactful. I'm not sure I would have been able to be as tactful with Secretary Preston when you talked about disasters, because the ultimate disaster is, of course, New Orleans. And, of course, our government played a major role in the way that so many families have not been able to get back to that city.
Well, of course, we've got the anniversary coming up, and we will be talking a lot more about that on the show. But right now, I want to ask you, Dr. Malveaux, about basically, we are still seeing this housing market in free fall. In July, the foreclosure rate increased by 8%. That was 55% since last July. So when you talk about having family wealth, people who have struggled to buy a little bit of land or an apartment or a house, and then you face the issue of what happens when an older generation passes on, now add to that the housing issues with mortgages. I mean, let me just unpack it bit by bit. One, if people are losing their homes, does that break a cycle of wealth transfer? Does that mean that the next generation might even be worse off than their parents?
Absolutely. We know that the foreclosure crisis is going to hit the African-American community much harder, perhaps impacting the amount of black wealth by reducing it as much as 40%. If someone, the way that most middle-class families accumulate wealth is through their homes. They buy something, you know, in the old days you bought it and you paid 20% down and you paid up the 80%. You, if you passed on, you left that to your children. You may leave it to one. You may leave it to a bunch of them. That was wealth. That was money that was passed on from generation to generation. Now you have elders who occasionally tap back into their mortgages. You also have unscrupulous people who push our elders into bad loans. And you end up with a situation where someone loses their home. That's money that someone isn't going to get. What do we use that money for? Down payments on homes for the next generation, college for the next generation. So you are going to look at the possibility of people being worse off.
Now, what happens when there, I mean, with family sizes being what they are today, sometimes you have two parents passing on to wealth onto one child. Sometimes you'll have one parent passing on to five kids. There's all sorts of scenarios. But in many cases, what I have seen among friends of mine is that you have, you know, obviously the matriarch and patriarch, and they've got some land, and once they pass on, they might have six kids and, you know, 20 grandkids, and all of a sudden nobody can find a will. You know, it's like madness. What happens, you know, what can you do to prevent a situation like that, first of all?
Well, children have to be able to talk to their parents about their wealth situation, especially when they're in their later years. And they have to be able to frame it in a way that doesn't seem greedy or, hey, I want your stuff. It should be more like, you know, have you made plans? Do you know that if there is no will, you know, the government is going to get half of what you leave. So in order to avoid that, what can we do? But it's a really touchy conversation. And it depends, of course, on the relationships that children have with their parents and grandchildren and others. You know, the literature is rife with the scheming sweet sister who walks away with the whole estate, or the, you know, the favorite grandchild who gets something when no one else does. And so all the family dynamics rush into play. Many parents wanting to avoid conflict among their children, avoid this conversation. But there's got to be a way, even if it's through an attorney, an advisor, and perhaps children might suggest to an attorney, can we have a conversation about this? The emotion has to be kept out of it. People get very emotional about money and about property. But the alternative is that when someone dies without a will, they have no say in who gets their money. I mean, I have a great story of someone who passed and had the divorce wasn't final. The ex got it. That was the legal
wife. What about a situation, Dr. Malveau, where you have people who want to do different things? That is, and this has again happened to several friends of mine, say that there's now 10 descendants who have part of a large parcel of land, and some want to sell to developers, some want to sell to other members of the family, some want to hold on, but they wish they had the money to buy the other pieces, but they don't. I mean, how do you resolve things like that?
That's when a lifetime of family relations as well as conflict resolution skills come in. Basically, if 10 people get a piece of land, everyone's entitled to a tenth of it. They've got to come up with a compromise. They can't all go off willy-nilly. But what tends to happen is whatever the relations were, big brother was never nice to little sister, so now she doesn't want to cooperate. So there have to be conversations about cooperation, someone with deep pockets perhaps buying people out. No one can do anything without everyone doing it if it's jointly left to them. So this is how you end up with a lot of family conflict.
Let's move on to an issue that is even closer to home, which is not just talking about transferring wealth after someone has passed on, but taking care of someone who may be getting ready to pass on or who may be in his or her sunset years. A lot of families have to just one morning wake up and face the fact that someone they love is not going to be around a lot longer. And then what do we do now? What are some of the resources economically that people should think about accessing if they have someone in their family who is terminally ill or critically ill?
Well, depending on the income level of the person, you know, there, of course, is Medicaid and Medicare. There is the American Council on Aging that has great resources. It's www.aoa.gov. American Organization on Aging, and there's something called ElderWeb, which I found also has really great resources. ElderWeb, E-L-D-E-R, WEB.com. But again, Farias, let's just step back a bit. The person is very ill and dying. This is a conversation that doesn't take place when someone is very ill and dying. It's a what-if conversation that takes place when they're healthy. Mom, you know, you're getting on in years. What do we do? What do you want to do? If you're not able, when you're not able to take care of yourself, do you want to come live with me? Do you want to live with someone else? Is there a retirement home you're interested in? You know, even the basic question, do you want to be sustained when you're in a coma? These are questions that you can't ask while the emergency is occurring. Siblings also have to have the question sooner rather than later. Most siblings, oftentimes in families, very different economic circumstances. Some are living large and some may be just making it. And so the question is, what if mom ended up with a $50,000 hospital bill? Or she's got to go to a nursing home that costs $5,000 a month. Guys, how are we going to handle it? And it's a non-emotional conversation. Sometimes you may want to look early on at insurance. There's long-term care insurance that can be obtained. It's pretty expensive, and the older the parent is, the more expensive it is. So if you've got a parent, you know, a little on the younger side of aging, that's something you may want to look at now. But really, the emergency case is looking at Medicare, Medicaid, insurances, and these things. The more sober way to do it is to look at it much earlier to have the conversation mm-hmm. when the parent can participate. I mean, a lot right. of times you've had parents say or siblings say, she told me what she wanted, and there are five different stories. So you really want to have the parent participating. That was Freudian, and I have four siblings. But... But you really want to have the parent participating in the conversation so their wishes are met.
Well, Dr. Malveau, thanks for the great advice. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Julianne Malveau is an author, economist, and the president of Bennett College.